Hi, everyone. I just wanted to remind you about our partnership with FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education. Are you between the ages of 14 and 26? I sure hope so. That's the age group I'd really like to have listening to this show. If the answer is yes, you are eligible to apply for FEE's three-day seminars. They are going to be held across the United States, and they are designed to teach young people like you the power of economic thinking. FEE's three-day seminars offer opportunities to learn economic principles that can affect your career prospects, investment decisions, business strategies, and more. Seminar topics include economics of entrepreneurship and the economics of business success, and offer opportunities for young people to learn new methods of thinking that can help them pursue future passions. So if you are between the ages of 14 and 26, please think about this opportunity to join students, successful business leaders, and great teachers in the discovery of the relationship between personal and social wealth, as well as the virtues of an enterprising life. The total tuition cost for the three-day seminar is $79. That includes all meals and housing. Tuition and travel reimbursement scholarships are available. There is no charge to apply. Applications are reviewed and accepted on a rolling basis. Apply today at fee.org/students and make sure you let them know in your application that you heard about this opportunity through the School Sucks podcast.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Good morning, everybody. This is Brett. Today is January 28th, and thank you so much for your participation in School Sucks Podcast 4.0.
Stop. Hammer time.
Indeed. And if you're not fond of that gag, it is going to be a long year for you, because I've been making a playlist. Bam. So, I'm really excited to welcome Jake DeSillis back to the show for the second time this month. Our first conversation, I say a must listen. We talked about the horizons of focus. That's a concept from David Allen's book, Getting Things Done. And it deals with something particularly grandiose, creating a vision for your very existence. But today we zoom way in to something as small and seemingly simple as what is the first thing you do in the morning when you get out of bed, and why? And then what do you do next? We're talking about habits. Now, habits and groups of habits together into routines like a morning routine may seem trivial, but Jake and I are going to discuss today how, for many of us, habits might indeed be the most important part of our larger systems of productivity. So that's it, folks. No time to waste. Let's get right to today's show. Big thanks again to Jake DeSillis for everything that he contributed to SSP Productivity Month. I highly recommend you check out Jake's work at thevoluntarylife.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day. Jake, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Brett. Great to be back.
Yes, you were here at the beginning of the month, and you're here again at the end of the month. We're back today to talk about another very, very important subject in productivity that is often overlooked, and that is habits.
Yeah. In fact, I think that habits is the one aspect of productivity in GTD that was a bit overlooked. You know, It's one of those things that I think David Allen didn't really cover in as much depth as I would have liked. So I do think it's a really important topic and one that kind of gets left out of GTD sometimes.
Well, yeah, you've said that habits, even though they often might seem trivial, they are one of the most important parts, if not the most important part of a productivity system.
Yeah, and I think habits, because we tend to focus on the big picture of like our projects that we want to get done. You know, oh, it's a new year. I'm going to have, these are the things I want to achieve. And this is what I'm excited about at the moment. And these are the big goals that I have and so forth. And so it's easy to think about those things, but habits are actually how you show up in the day to day. And that's where your character is demonstrated. And it's also where, you know, your all the things that are most important to you should really show up in the habits that you do every day. So although it seems like these are the kind of mundane things, actually habits are where you really demonstrate who you are. And not only that, but I think the thing that I really came to understand and I had to learn sort of the hard way for myself is that I find it easy to think about a big goal and something that I want to achieve and then to think, right, I'm going to go for this. I'm going to put all my effort into it and, you know, really power through and I'm going to get this done and make this massive effort. And then at the end of it, this goal is achieved. When actually the real power of habits is that the long, consistent process of doing something repeatedly every day or every week or month or whatever it is, that is so much more productive than the mad dash, you know?
Yeah, it's this idea of slow and steady versus the New Year's resolution approach, right? Which are both approaches to change that people use. I know this time of year, the latter is much more popular, but the slow and steady approach, and I found this really over the course of 2015, this is something that we're going to talk about today in the development of some new personal daily routines, was much more effective than, you know, the approaches that I had tried before where I would say something like, okay, come Monday. Today's Monday, and Monday is always a great day to reset, or at least we think it is. And, you know, if we find that we're really blowing it by Thursday, we can say, well, you know, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday are shot. But wait till you see what I do next Monday. So, yeah, and then that idea that everything is going to change on that day. My last guest, Kevin Geary, talks about this mostly in the health and fitness sphere, which is the bank account philosophy, right? Just make sure you're making more deposits than withdrawals. So if you think about that on a small scale, you say, okay, I have to get up today and make deposits. There's no reason why I have to wait to make a deposit, even if withdrawals are coming. And when you add to that this idea that you mentioned, the things you do over and over make you who you are, or they transform who you are into who you want to be. It relates to what you were saying before in our previous show about living consciously through all aspects of life.
Yes, absolutely. If you have a purpose in life, and if you, you know, in terms of the discussion that we had previously about horizons of focus, if you know what's important to you, then you should be able to see that in the habits that you do every day. And if you don't, then the question is, well, how are you going to live your purpose if it's not showing up in those habits that you do every day?
So let's just help people understand this, people who are new. Like, what for you constitutes a habit? Because we're usually talking about things that are pretty small. And a lot of the times when people are, you know, I've certainly had this experience myself, when things are really busy, it's always those repetitive habits that suffer. I don't have time to journal today. I don't have time to, you know, sit quietly for 5 to 10 minutes today because I got to get right to it, right? So what are we talking about?
I think of habits as those things that you do repeatedly on a repeated basis. Maybe it's a daily habit, or sometimes like I have some weekly and monthly habits too. But the thing about habits is that they tend to be things also that have a trigger, that there's something that will get you to do this thing. And then there's also a reward, something that happens at the end of it, which is what makes you do the habit. And that's true for bad habits too.
Absolutely.
There may be things that you don't feel good about doing repeatedly, but you know that there's a trigger, you know, oh, I'm sitting at my laptop and I'm bored, so I'm going to check Facebook. And then there's a reward, which is, oh, look, there's some stuff that I can read and some new things there, you know. And maybe that's something that you feel like, okay, I'm doing this this is getting in the way of other goals that I have and so forth. But good and bad habits have got this trigger and this reward thing. But the thing for me that I really sort of had to try and get my head around is that the key thing about habits is also that they should be things that you can just do without having a lot of thought about it. They need to be things that you almost do on autopilot, that you know what you're going to do and you're able to just get on with it. Because the more thinking that you have to do in order for the habit to take place, the more willpower it saps and the more energy it saps and the harder it is for that habit to actually be something that you can maintain. And that's why a lot of the habits that you may not be so happy with are hard to quit, because they're things that you can almost do on autopilot. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot of energy to check Facebook, but so this is the sort of the key I found is to changing habits is to think about, okay, how can I be conscious of what the trigger is, what the reward is, and also how do I make this something that is so easy that I can do it on autopilot?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you mentioned a book in your discussion about habits on The Voluntary Life by Charles Duhigg called The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. And in this book, he uses the work of Albert Ellis, the cognitive behavioral therapist. ABC, antecedent behavior consequence model. And basically what he says is that, you know, some kind of habit is initiated by a cue, which you're discussing, or a trigger that signals automatic or some kind of habitual behavior. In this case, bad, right? So I think what, and I'd like to hear more about, you know, the value you got out of The Power of Habit, but what he's pushing is this idea that a situation can come up where a person can essentially adopt a problem-solving mode of thinking to develop an appropriate response. And this is often something that goes from automated reaction to creative thinking, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I found that book very helpful, and it made me think about this question of what are my triggers and what are the rewards that I can get from the habits that I'm doing. So, I mean, I can sort of tell you about my own experience.
Sure, yeah. I'd love to hear your experience, and then I can share some of mine.
Well, I mean, for example, I found that one of the really hard things, you mentioned when we were just starting to talk about this, you mentioned exercise. One of the really hard things about implementing habits is those habits that don't have an obvious payoff. Like, for example, if you go and do some exercise, you can feel good about yourself that you've done some exercise, but it's not like you immediately get fitter. You know, it's a slow thing. It takes ages for the impact to actually be seen. It's not like, you know, if you go and work out, then suddenly, you know, you look leaner and fitter or anything like that, or you immediately have more energy or whatever. And sometimes you just feel exhausted after having done it. So this is an example of one of those things where you have a goal, but the problem is that the reward is way off somewhere in the future. And that the habit, each time you do it, you know, it's not that rewarding. And I mean, I'll give you another example. When I'm writing, if I'm writing a book, you know, the finished book is way off in the future. And the actual writing of it, sometimes I'll write a bunch of stuff that eventually is not, you know, doesn't even get in the book. Or I'll write stuff that, you know, it helps me clarify my own thinking, but then I realize that I'm going to change the direction and of what I'm writing and so forth. So one of the things that I found really helpful was to think about, okay, well, how can I sort of find intermediate rewards that help me in terms of getting towards that longer term goal, whether it's with exercise or writing, you know, or whatever it is that other people have as habits that they want to implement. And so, for example, I've found that when I do things like track my exercise, and I have, even on a really simple level, if you have something like a Fitbit and it tells you when you've walked 10,000 steps, and then, you know, that's an intermediate reward. It's like you can see your little fitness app give you that alert, and you know that you've achieved something, and it sort of gamifies the process, and it gives you that intermediate reward that is, you know, even though I don't feel fitter, I know that I've achieved a goal for the day, which is a simple one, like walk 10,000 steps.
Right.
And that gives me a sense of achievement, which is its own reward.
Yeah.
And so... does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, here's my thing, right? Because this kind of relates to something that we touched on in the last show, the quantified self, where sometimes the reward is conscious living. And what I mean by that is, like, I go to the gym. I try to go 5 days a week. Almost everybody in my gym is walking around without a notebook. And this isn't a new phenomenon, right? Because notebooks could have been replaced with, you know, some kind of mobile tracking device or a Fitbit. this is something that I've seen over the last 15 years. And I say, are these people mad? How do they even know what they're doing? Why are they here? You know, if they're not writing things down, that was always my response. And for years, I would go and I would keep like a log of what I did that day, you know, mostly related to weights, because with weights, you're trying to eventually do more. And I realized that I was never really referencing back what I did. You know, maybe I would look and say, okay, what did I do last time? Need to try for more this time. And what I eventually adopted was a system of, I open a page, you know, so there's a left in a notebook. So there's a left page and a right page, and that's the whole week. On the left side of the page is the stuff I do with weights. On the right side of the page is a day by day, how many steps did I walk and what other activities did I do? So I can see the whole week every time that I open it. And this has really helped me quantify what I'm doing. Now, I'm at a pretty good level of fitness right now, I would say. So when I started this, or if I take a couple months off and then get back into it, yeah, you know, it is frustrating at first, but there's a real push in just, okay, today is Wednesday. Ah, I see I was here Monday. I see I did some things. I made it through that day. You start to see these pages fill up. And even if you're not seeing the results you want, you are seeing your progress. You're seeing a log of your activity. And that is really, really helpful.
Yeah, you've got something to show for it. And that's the key thing, is that I think it's really difficult when you have a very long-term task, or a long-term goal rather, and it just feels like you're not really making progress because you can't see the progress. But if you've got something to show for it, even if it's as simple as, you know, my Fitbit app tracking my steps and showing me a graph and showing me how much I've done each month, and you've got your journal from weights and so forth, then it gives you that sense that you are making progress. And therefore, you know, it's actually that is its own reward.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you talk about triggers for activating habits, what I think of is time of day primarily. Mm. Right. Because there are times of day in most people's lives where things happen. You know, I get up every morning that I'm alive and go to bed every night that I'm alive. So those are times where routines start to build. And there might be eventually a midday routine. Last year, developing a morning routine was really important to me. And now I'm looking at, okay, well, what kind of repetition do I have at the middle of the day? What kind of repetition do I have at the end of the day? And what kind of beneficial things can be added into those spots? So does that relate to the triggering or cues for positive habits being developed, time of day?
Yeah. I mean, I find that really helpful, especially because you can look at your day and think, what do I really want to get done that's important? And I mean, another book that I found very helpful thinking about this is a book called Willpower by Baumeister. And he makes the point that, you know, you only have a limited budget of willpower in a day, and that it does cost you energy. It costs mental energy. It actually uses up glucose to think through and make decisions about things. So if you want habits, if you want to make sure that you get important things done, you can think about when to do them. And for example, when I'm writing a book, I always write in the morning, because that's the time when I, you know, I want to get the most important thing done, just doing my writing. And so you having those time triggers is really helpful, especially when you want to think about when would be a good time to do things. And also because it means that you can, for example, if you have a morning routine, you can do things on autopilot. But there's another way of thinking about triggers too, which is to train your mind to associate an activity with the triggers that you want to use for it. So for example, I have a playlist of music that I listen to when I'm writing. And that playlist, I change it, you know, probably like once every 6 months to a year, but it generally is pretty much the same thing that I'm listening to, usually instrumental. And when I'm writing, I put one app in full screen mode and I'm listening to that music. And that's another signal, like, okay, this is writing time. You know, this is what I'm doing now. And you can build whatever triggers you want into your routines to make yourself feel like this is the time when I do this particular thing. For example, I know some people who enjoy when they're doing a weekly review, they're getting things done review, they like to go to, one guy likes to go to Starbucks and he has a special order that he orders every time. And it's his, like his treat for when he's having, doing his weekly review is to go and sit in a cafe and be out of his normal environment. And that sort of triggers his mind to think, okay, now it's a different thing from my normal routine. Now I'm having a review and I'm going to have this coffee that's my kind of treat for doing it and so forth. So I think time triggers are great, but you can build in as many different types of mood triggers as well to give you the sense of like, okay, this is telling my brain that this is the time to do that thing I keep doing whenever this music is playing, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk a little bit more about willpower, so we'll put a bookmark in that. But the opposite of triggers, you know, positive triggers, is this kind of friction that we encounter. And I've experienced this where I say, okay, every day at 3 o'clock, I'm going to do this thing. And maybe we could even use going to the gym. Like I had on my calendar for the longest time, 2 p.m. gym. And then like 1:45 rolls around and just, you know, every day is different. And I'd be like, well, why would I do that right now? You know, that doesn't make any sense right now. I don't feel like going right now. I usually feel like going either at, you know, 4 or 7 p.m. or something like that. So we can actually, just by trying to shove something into the day, create a kind of friction against the development of a habit, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest friction I experience is when a habit is something I want to do, but I can't just do it on autopilot. There's the friction is the thing that's stopping me doing it on autopilot. Like I have to think about, oh, wait a minute, what do I need in order to do this habit? So for example, I've had for a long time a habit that I want to make sure, one of the things that's really important to me is learning. I want to continue learning. Mm-hmm. And I've had this habit that, okay, I want to make sure that I'm learning something new every day. And it's a simple thing, you know, to say, okay, I want to make sure I'm learning something new every day. And at the moment, for example, we live in Panama, and so I'm doing Spanish every day, and it's great. I really enjoy it. And I have a language app on my iPad that I use, and I'm doing that every day, and it's really good. But sometimes, and in the past, for example, I've done IT courses where I've been learning about how to use different applications or how to script applications. But there's sometimes when I'm not learning a language or I'm not signed up to any particular IT course. And then having that habit is actually kind of stressful because I get to that point in the day, I think, well, what am I going to learn? I don't know. I mean, I guess, what have I got any books to read? I try and think about what it is that I'm going to do, but it's not queued up and it's not something that I can just, like at the moment, I can just open my iPad and I'm immediately in the language app and I'm learning Spanish and mm-hmm. it's just easy to do. There's no friction whatsoever. But if I don't have that queued up, if I don't have something ready, then that habit just becomes an actual drain of energy because it takes processing time for me to think like, well, what am I going to learn? What would be useful at the moment? And that's friction. That's how I experience friction.
Yeah, that it's not automatic enough, basically.
Yeah, that's why I think you do need some habits, do need some kind of background maintenance work to keep them on a kind of autopilot level. Like if it's really important to you to be able to do exercise at a particular time of day, then you've got to make sure that everything you need is just going to be there and it's going to be available and it's going to be easy and you don't need a lot of time to get your gym stuff on or whatever it is. And in my example, you know, I need to make sure if I want to be learning stuff every day that I know ahead of time what I'm going to be learning. And it's the same, for example, with writing. It's like when I have a habit of writing every day. And when I'm in the middle of doing a book, that's so easy because I've got loads of stuff that I'm really wanting to write down. But at the moment, for example, I've just finished a book and now I've got various different writing projects. And it's actually quite difficult because I haven't really properly queued up what it is that I'm writing. And so there's more effort involved in thinking about it. And I need to do, at the moment, I need to do more prep work to make sure that I actually know that my brain has sort of already got in the back of my mind somewhere, I've got like, this is what I need to be thinking, mulling over, so that when next time I sit down to write, I've got some stuff to write about.
Okay, so when it comes to prep work versus execution, you talk about the morning being a particularly productive, high-value time, right? This is something that a lot of people have said, including one of my recent guests, Kevin Cruz, you know, talked about being really, really mindful of your morning and being focused on what your most important task is. But he also talked about a kind of setup for, you know, the day ahead. If you need to get clarity on what that task is and what that task involves, do you devote time to that like the day before, or how does that usually work for you?
Yeah, and ideally, not just the day before, but I want to be planning like in the weeks ahead, what is my writing project going to be, so that I've got a longer plan than just like, okay, well, what am I going to write tomorrow? I need to have mulled it over more so that I've got a bigger picture of what I'm trying to achieve. So that's, for example, with writing, but certainly with any of these projects. And that's true also, by the way, with the learning project. You know, now that I'm doing Spanish, I need to know that I've got Spanish stuff to learn queued up for every day for the foreseeable next weeks and months. And for example, because I'm using a language app, that's easy to do. But when I'm learning IT stuff, then if I've got a course scheduled like that I can do a little bit on each day, that's also not just for tomorrow, but ideally for even further ahead than that.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the autopilot idea, because one of the greatest procrastination triggers for me is not knowing where to start.
Yeah,
you know,
totally. It's the more willpower that is required and the more processing that is required, the harder it's going to be to do and the easier it's going to be to procrastinate. Mm-hmm. So the more you can even like, and the more you can take away those friction points, the easier. I'll give you another example. A habit that I have had for some time now, which has become really important to me, is actually a monthly habit. And that is doing a monthly financial review, where I get all of my financial data from my banks and my investments. And I basically look at my spending and I look at exactly where I am with regard to budget and so forth. And it's one of those things that there's loads of fiddly little technical tasks involved in downloading this and updating that, and a lot of stuff to remember. And if I had to get to each month and think, okay, what do I need to do again? I guess I got to download this, I got to download that. Then the whole task would be totally exhausting and it would be much easier for me to procrastinate and not do it. So what I've done is I've made a full list of everything that I have to do to do a monthly financial review. Every little task, I just can just go through this list. It's actually in my task manager in OmniFocus as a repeating project. But the point is, there's all these little detailed tasks to do, but I don't have to remember any of that. I just have to tick them off one by one, because I've already done the thinking ahead of time, which says, okay, first I do this, next I do that, then after that I do this. And so all I need to do is just sit down and go through, run through and tick off all these things. And that's actually, you know, you get a sense of reward from doing that, because you can actually feel that you're getting things done and you're productive and so forth. But if I had to think that through every time, then that task would be just so boring and exhausting that it would be very hard to maintain it as a habit.
Yeah. You know, earlier this month, like right at the beginning of this month, I realized that the production flow for the podcast was going to change. We were working with a sponsor this month. There was going to be extra things added onto the show. The ways the shows were presented as finished products was going to change. And it was a bigger project than it had been in the past. And I wrote out just a step-by-step production flow. And I don't think I fully realized it while I was doing it, but I guess I had learned that lack of clarity stops productivity in the past. You know, so when you have that thing that is going to repeat, whether it's, you know, 9 or 10 times a month for me, or even just once a month for you, reducing those obstacles by having a, you know, clear map, or really a clear path to walk, is enormously beneficial. Because whenever I can even recently remember working on complex projects and saying, okay, I'll sit and I'll just pause for a second and I'll say, what's next? And then the next thing I know, I've gotten up, I've walked out of my office, I've wandered down the hall. I don't even know why. I don't even know where I'm going, right? I'm on autopilot, but not in a productive way. I just hit some kind of a roadblock and wound up wandering away from the thing that I was doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that hasn't happened as much using a production flow map for that process.
Yeah, and the great thing is that there's so many more benefits once you do that as well. Because if you map out your production flow, then not only is it going to help you, those bits that you just need to do as habits that you need to tick through, they will take less mental energy and will be easier to do, which means that you don't need to do them in your prime time. You can do them sometime late afternoon when you're starting to get exhausted and, you know, when you've already done really creative work for the day, because they don't take any mental headspace. But not only that, mapping it out not only helps you with your habits, but it also is, it makes it very obvious where there are things that you could automate or things that you could potentially delegate or other things that you don't necessarily need to do. It's just a way of being more conscious about your work, which can have all these other potential opportunities to then not even do that anymore, but, you know, automate it, script it, or give it to somebody else to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the morning routine works that way as well. I think like mental clarity hits after I've been up for a little while, right?
Right.
But I have a list. It is, you know, it's in Evernote and I check things off every day and it is written out and pasted to the back of my bedroom door. Like, these are the things that should happen before you leave this room. And these are the things that should happen immediately after you leave it. And I find that is really, really helpful. And putting everything on there, even the simplest things like make coffee or tea, because it moves me to the next part of that routine. You know, once I have the tea or the coffee made, I can sit down at my desk and I can write in a journal. Do you have a specific routine that you follow each morning?
I do, yeah. And I've actually, it's changed because we have come to Panama and we're in a different house now, and we're, you know, like, we've got a different environment. And so, because one of the things that I have been doing since we got here is I've decided just to do exercise first thing in the morning. Back when we were in the UK, I got up and my morning routine was, before anything else, I want to write, because that was really what gave me the sense of, okay, this is now the most important thing, that if I get this done, then my day is really set up, and that, you know, that feels really good. But actually, I've decided that the thing that requires, frankly, the most willpower for me, and the thing that also is often easiest for me to put off and not do, is exercise. And so I've decided that is something that I do every morning. And we have a pool here, so I go swimming first thing in the morning, and then I do some yoga, and then I have coffee as my kind of reward for having done that. But even then, you know, in the last couple of weeks, I've been ill. And when I'm in pain or when I'm not well, then I'm not going to do that morning routine. And so now I have to get back into the routine. Now that I'm almost well again, I have to get back into the routine. You know, so even having set the routine, you know, there are things that can throw me off.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, what I found was, okay, make a routine for Monday through Friday. Because on the weekends, I try to get out, I try to get away from the office, I go to different places. And I mentioned this a couple of times earlier in the month. It's very, very hard to, you know, wake up on a different kind of day, or even wake up in a different place, you know, where it's not my bed to make, or this isn't my house, and this isn't my coffee maker, and, you know, yes, and all those things. It's very, very difficult to execute. And having, you know, a Saturday or a Sunday where you say, I'm supposed to be doing these things, but I'm not, can throw me off even longer than just Saturday and Sunday. Yeah. You know, once the routine is broken, there's this part of my mind that goes, shit, you broke it, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe someday, maybe two Mondays from now, or on January 1st of next year, you know, you'll get it back. But it's shot for now. So I just set Monday through Friday. Now, yeah, you're right. There are things that come up that can even throw, you know, Monday through Friday out of sync. But a more time-specific kind of routine was really, really helpful for me. I mean, I talked earlier in the month about December of last year was really the first month after building it through most of 2015 that I felt I had a really well-developed morning routine that was working for me. You know, where a lot of important things were getting done. And you talked about, you know, willpower as a scarce resource, but also this idea that willpower degrades basically decision to decision throughout the day, you know? So I can make it to the gym at 7 p.m. because it's part of my daily routine. But then there's a lot of seemingly more inconsequential things that would definitely fall by the wayside, especially if I got really busy. But if they're all taken care of, you know, in the first 45 minutes that I'm awake, and then that immediately transitions into doing like a work block of three Pomodoros, which aren't spent answering emails. You know, because I don't really see that as a high yield creative activity, doing what I think is the most important thing to get done that day. By the time noon rolls around, I'm already feeling pretty good about a day that I still have, you know, 11 or 12 hours to experience.
Yeah, that makes total sense. There's a lot in what you said that that resonates for me. But I think in particular, what you were saying about the weekend really reminds me of the times in my life when I have felt under enormous pressure, you know, in for example, during many stages of building my business, when I didn't really have any difference between weekend and weekday, or even like particularly day or night. I just worked until I was exhausted and then got up and did more. And I know, looking back on those times, that even though I was working through the weekend for weeks on end, and sometimes, I know that I was really not productive. Like I would go into the office to continue working on my business at the weekends, and I would also feel like, okay, well, I'm doing something because I'm coming into the office, but I was so tired that I wasn't really making good decisions or being able to think things through quickly or effectively. And consequently, it was actually not worth it. It was just that I was too stressed to allow myself to relax, to allow myself to say, right, that's good. I've done a productive week. I'm going to have some time off at the weekend, and I'm going to recuperate and give my brain a break as well. And I realize now that is a really bad plan to try and just power through everything. That with routines and habits, especially ones that require willpower and especially ones that require decision making, you have to rest and you have to be able to have productive time where you're working on something very intensively, and also have time where you recuperate, you get good sleep, and for example, where you actually have a relaxing time at the weekend with your partner or, you know, friends or whatever you're doing. You have time to have more to your life than just trying to get these, you know, most important tasks done.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of us, certainly I've done this myself, tell a story that's like, oh, well, if you do what you love, it's not work. So you think I'm never working. But there's a catch, right, to that, where sitting at a desk and staring at a computer screen is work for my body and for my eyes. Those are not things it was really designed to do all day. So then there are going to be, you know, health costs to doing that. And just, you know, sitting there, you know, going to bed, having walked 847 steps in an entire day, you know, and said, gosh, I love that I never have to work, is a separate set of problems. And also, I think part of that too is like conflating busy with productive, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And really like making work, or whatever you want to call it, the thing you do that you love that produces an income, out of balance with the rest of your life, carrying too much weight in the rest of your life. And I certainly found that. I mean, there was a time where I went and just lived temporarily in another town for 6 months. So I was in like a really confined space where I was actually working and sleeping in the same room for, you know, like I said, a period of maybe 6 months. And there was no line between work and anything else. I just get up and my desk was right there, and it was the room that I hung out in, and work was the only thing to do. And, you know, I got a lot done, but it wasn't sustainable. And the rest of life, especially like a social life, was really, really out of balance because of that.
It really comes back to that point we were talking about earlier on about triggers, that if your work and your social life and your home life and your recuperation, if it's all happening in one room, in your bedroom with a desk, then there's no triggers to tell your brain, okay, now's the time to relax. Now's the time to think about work. Now's the time to have fun with friends or whatever. And so you're not really, you know, fully immersed in any of those activities. When you're relaxing, your laptop's just over there and you can think about, oh, well, maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that. When you're working, the bed's over there and you can think, oh, I could really do with a snooze right now, you know. So I think it can be really helpful to actually give yourself different physical triggers, like we talked about, different music, different environments and so forth. One of the things I like about going swimming in the morning is that one of the things that I find is that I love reading and books and new information. I'm always listening to podcasts. I'm always taking in stuff. And I have to be conscious about giving myself time to think and actually, you know, not to be absorbing new information. And going for a swim in the morning, you know, I'm not listening to podcasts or anything. It's a time when I just have a think. You know, and it's mm-hmm. a really nice time to be able to actually, before any new inputs, before I'm looking at any new things, I just get a time to almost meditate myself and just have my own thoughts before the kind of information overload starts.
Yeah, absolutely. How about tracking or building new habits? What kind of tools do you use for that? I have one that I've used called 7 Weeks, which is basically just an app, asks you if you did a thing or not. You know, you program it for a new habit, and every day you check off whether you did it or not. And that kind of quantification, just like I talked about with the gym, making an X or a green check mark was helpful last year in building a routine for the morning. What kinds of things do you use?
That's a great question, because it took me a while to find tools that really helped me with this. I started off putting repeating tasks into my task management system, OmniFocus, and that really was not helpful. In fact, it just cluttered up my system with stuff that really didn't belong there. I don't think habits are quite the same thing as tasks in a project, at least not for me. So I stopped doing that. So I found that there are two types of apps that I find really, really helpful. One is to have an app that gives you triggers for things. It's the same sort of thing. It's a tracking app that I use, which is probably similar to yours. I used to use one called Lyft on the phone, but I now use, let me just check what the name is of the new one. I now use one called Way of Life, which is slightly different. Lyft got changed and they changed their focus to be more of a coaching app, and I didn't really like it. But Way of Life is essentially just like the one that you talked about. I can put the habits in that I'm currently working on and concentrating on, and each day I simply tick them off. That's all there is to it. It just gives me a reminder of what my habits are that I'm focusing on, and it gives me a way of tracking whether or not I've done them.
Yeah.
But the other thing I find really helpful is to find apps that are going to give you that sense of intermediate reward. That's really helpful. I mean, for example, I'm using on my Scrivener application, which is the one that I write with, I can get an alert when I have worked for more than an hour on writing, or when I've written 750 words. I can get it to give me an alert so that I know, like, I've achieved a goal, which was to write for at least an hour or to write at least 750 words. And that gives me an alert, which gives me that sense of having achieved something that I wanted to do every day. And the same goes for the tracking of, for example, the number of steps that I walk. I will get an alert that I have done 10,000 steps, and then I know that I've achieved something. And those, I think, can be really helpful too. And that's something that you can use apps to give you that feedback, that intermediate reward on those things that you want to work long term on. But habit apps are very simple. The ones that I've found most useful, like this one on my phone, it's just simply a list of the different names of the habits that I'm focusing on. And then each day you just tick off whether you do it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, these apps that we use fit into a larger context that I would call the resources that we have. You know, and a way to think about this, are you familiar with Al Switzler?
No.
He co-founded a company called Vital Smarts, and what they do is they basically research methods for driving measurable behavior change, ones that can also be maintained. So he's written several books. One is called Change Anything, and there's a TED Talk that he did, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. In the last 10 years, you know, I've had to change some very serious bad habits. And one of the most helpful things in doing that was to basically create what I would call a pro Brett environment, you know, where all of these different things in my life are supportive of this mission that I'm trying to accomplish. And this goes back to this idea of willpower. We could assume, just hypothetically for a second, that we have endless amounts of it, which we know we don't, even, you know, throughout a single day. You know, so willpower exists in this first container of personal resources. You know, we have a desire to do something, and then there's the ability to do that thing. And then beyond that, there's like a social context. Do we have, you know, support from other people? And do we have coaches or mentors or people who can just be helpful along the way with, like you're being for me right now, I use this, I use that kind of a thing. But then there's, you know, a structural context beyond that. The first part of that would be like incentives and then, you know, being in the right place to make good behavior easy and bad behavior hard. So I think that's a bigger picture of trying to adopt things that are good for us and eliminate things that are bad for us. Willpower is always talked up, and we've discussed this in this show and previously, that it only goes so far. And beyond that, you have these five other considerations that are all really important. The ability, the know-how, which we talked about through something like planning, right? Do I even know what I'm trying to do next? Support from other people, which is something that we try to provide in a community like School Sucks, or like you try to provide in the voluntary life. And then a kind of social ability context as well, which would be like, are there people available to help beyond just saying good job or I'm struggling with that too? Are there people who actually have answers, which maybe we try to do to a certain extent as well? And then the structural context that exists beyond those first four, what are the incentives, which we talked about with fitness and even finding, you know, short or midterm incentives, like feeling like you're living a conscious life, and then being in the right place to make good things happen and, you know, stopping bad things from happening. You know, like if you want to quit drinking, don't live in an apartment that's above a bar.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And especially for things like you mentioned drinking, but also, you know, eating habits and stuff like that. These things that you can do to prevent your depletion of willpower ahead of time. Like if you don't want to eat certain things, then you just shouldn't have them in the house. You should just not ever have them in the cupboard. Because if you do, like, let's say you don't want to eat sweets or chocolate or something, but you have that in the house, then it's going to be there and it's going to be a temptation. And there will be times in your day when you're exhausted and tired and you need a little perk. And then, you know, you need to give yourself a treat. And if the treat is right there, then you're going to use it because your willpower would be depleted. It's almost like we are multiple personalities. You know, there's the me that has willpower and thinks ahead. And then there's the exhausted me that doesn't have the willpower. And I've got a plan for the exhausted me to have the right conditions and circumstances so that the exhausted me is going to be supported as well. And not the exhausted me is suddenly going to have to try and find new reserves of willpower. So I think that thing that you talked about having the right conditions is really, really important and really helpful. And the other thing that you mentioned that made a lot of sense to me is the social support, you know. And I found, for example, with habits that it is really helpful if you have other people who you can have accountability with and also who can give you some moral support when you're trying to kind of make sure that you keep doing something. I mean, you can often do this through apps, and with Fitbit, you can have friends on the Fitbit and you can have like week competitions with your friends where you all try and achieve a certain goal or you see who walks the most steps and this kind of stuff. And I actually find that quite helpful because it means that it's not just me on my own, doing these habits, but I also have some accountability with friends too.
Yeah, absolutely. The circles that we run in makes such a huge difference. And I said in a snarky way on my show a long time ago, you know, there's a reason why, you know, heroin addicts don't hang out with joggers, you know, and why cops hang out with cops, right? Yeah. Because they're looking for people who can normalize what I think they know deep down is bad behavior.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a broader social way, you know, it reminds me of this quote. Have you ever heard the William James quote? Do you know who William James is?
See, he was a writer, wasn't he?
Henry James was a writer. Henry James was his brother, actually.
Okay.
And William James was a psychologist. And he wrote a book in 1890 called The Principles of Psychology. And in that book exists this gem. Are you ready for this quote?
Go for it. Go for
Habit is the enormous flywheel of society, its most precious conservative agent. It alone is what keeps us all within the bounds of ordinance, and it saves the children of fortune from the envious uprisings of the poor. Unquote.
Wow.
And if you think about that in that time, a kind of progressive-minded academic type who's, you know, basically making a plan for all of society, this was a desirable outcome of ingrained habits. It keeps things as they are supposed to be. And I think that relates to what you said. I think this is reinforcement for one of the first points that you made in the show. The things you do make you who you are.
Yeah.
This enormous flywheel of society maintains things as they're supposed to be, generation after generation. For those of us who are conservative in the sense that we are basically, you know, as Woodrow Wilson, to paraphrase again, we want one class of people to live these enlightened lives while we want everybody else to perform specific difficult manual tasks. This automatic behavior set that the less fortunate seems to have is a great asset because they will never learn their way out of doing those things. They're made who they are by this enormous flywheel.
Wow. Well, there's obviously a lot going on with that quote in terms of his views of society and so forth. But what it makes me think of in terms of things that are relevant at the individual level, at what we can do for ourselves, what it makes me think about is with habit, it reminds me of the kind of process of entropy, you know, that idea that the physical universe is just moving from a more ordered to a more entropic state, you know, to a more, everything's just basically always going to a less ordered state. And we humans, what's special about us is that we are injecting order into the universe. That's what makes us special, is that we actually stop entropy. We actually create order. And in our own lives, I think about that in terms of, you know, if you don't have habits to keep things, to keep yourself moving forward in terms of where you want the order that you want to bring to your own life, then entropy will get you. And before you know it, you know, there'll be stuff coming up and new exciting things happening and a new challenge and whatever plans you had for the kind of person that you want to be, the kind of life that you want to live and the purpose that you want to embody in why you are here, that will all go out the window. Entropy will just get rid of it all. Whereas habits are the way that you bring order to your life. You actually create your own choices in the world and put your own personality and your own sense of purpose into the universe. And you actually push against that process of everything falling apart. You create something. That's what's so special about us, is that we create something. And so that's one of the things that I think habits, as we talked about in the beginning, they seem like stupid, trivial little things that are annoying and getting in the way of our big plans. But actually, they are the tool for being the person that you want to be in the world. And if you think of them in those terms, then you can actually get excited about, okay, how can I show up as the kind of person I want to be through habits? What would it take for me to go from where I am now to the person I really want to be in terms of the everyday way that I show up in the world? And how can I implement that?
Yeah, and it's this idea that no matter what else is going on around you, do these simple things. Gain control over that first sphere. Yeah. I remember I was going through a particularly distressing time in 2010. And it was while I was doing the show and, you know, really committed to moving these ideas forward, but I felt like my personal life was kind of disastrous at the time. I even talked about it on the show. Wes Bertrand and I did a whole series about it called Escape from Imagination Land, about, you know, the lack of empathy that we show sometimes towards political people when our own side of the road might not necessarily be swept, you know?
Right.
And I woke up one day and I think I said to myself out loud, I looked around and my living situation was fairly chaotic at the time. And I said, you know, I think a better world probably starts with a clean room, you know, and that was it. That was something that changed me significantly, even though it sounds like kind of a simple and stupid thing to say. A better world probably starts with a clean room, right? So we talk about having all these aspirations for this world that we want to see as, you know, people who are promoting the philosophy of liberty, that first sphere of control. To have it there so then I can move forward into the chaos or the entropy of the rest of the world and be equipped to eventually deal with that.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I mean, I think that's so important. That is such an important foundation of integrity, that if you don't have your own life in order, if you don't have a sense of control and a sense of purpose in your own life, then who cares about what you have to say about the rest of the world? And I mean that for myself and for everyone that I meet. You know, it's like the way that we show up in terms of our personal relationships, in terms of our own activity, in terms of our productivity and how we live our own lives is so fundamental to our integrity that if you haven't got your own shit together, then, you know, whatever you say about how the world should be and how the rest of humanity ought to behave is totally irrelevant because you know this the lack of basic integrity. And that's something that I really makes me think I have a huge responsibility first and foremost to get my own shit together before I say anything about the rest of the world.
Yeah, you know, and I do want to say too that it's an ongoing process. In 2010, that compared to today is a complete disaster, and I'm so glad not to be there anymore. I look forward to where I'll be 5 years from now. And I think that has made me actually more cautious that this is a process. This is ongoing, this self-improvement. It's made me more cautious about who I'll openly criticize now or how I will speak declaratively about things now, because I know I'm still trying to work towards self-actualization and self-improvement. And that might be a lifelong process, but I think the important thing is that you're being mindful of it and that you're doing it even if you're not done, because you may never be done. But when that wasn't my mindset, I was so much more willing to tear other people and other ideas down than I am today. I think there's a kind of humility that didn't exist then. You know, when you get all of this gift of this philosophy and you say, oh, fantastic, I'm right about everything. How nice. You know, for me, that wasn't a good thing when it came. It didn't help my relationships. It didn't help, you know, my focus on myself because there were so many externals to be focused on. And it produced a lot of problems initially. So now I'm just cautious about what I do, knowing that I am still very much trying to get my own house in order, but also being grateful for the progress I've made to that end in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. And in terms of still trying to get my own house in order, you know, you and me both, this is a lifelong process. And I'm not saying like, oh, I've sorted all of this stuff out. This is absolutely a lifelong process of addressing self-improvement and self-awareness, self-consciousness, and so forth. So I agree with everything that you said. The important thing for me, I think, is that the focus in this lifelong process starts with yourself, your own life, and starts with what seem like trivial things like habits, because that's actually where you show up. I used to think about society as being this thing out there somewhere. Society was out there, and I would try and think about how does society work? And, you know, society starts in your life, in what you do every day with the people that you meet and the interactions that you have. That's if society means anything, that's the most meaningful way that it shows up for you, is your actions in your own life. And when I think about that, this lifelong process means that, you know, if I want to have any integrity, I have to start with a focus on what I can do in my own life, in my own relationships, and what I can demonstrate in the way that I live, both to myself and to the people who matter to me, about, you know, what I think a good way to live is. And so this is where, you know, habits can actually be deeply a part of your philosophy and your approach to life as a whole.
Absolutely. Well said. And that covers it, Jake. Thank you so much for coming back on School Sucks Productivity Month. Can you give your website for everybody? And by the way, I want to say, before you give your website, I highly recommend your podcast. Everything that you do, no matter how much information you pack into a show, you have this amazing talent of making it like less than 30 minutes. And I'm just so, my mind is blown by that. You get a really, really high impact mental workout where you can walk away with a lot of valuable information in a very, very short amount of time. So I really, really appreciate the work you do for many other reasons, but that is one that I'm particularly impressed with.
Thank you very much, Brett. I really appreciate that. Yeah, the website is called thevoluntarylife.com and you can find everything there.
Excellent. Thanks again, Jake.
Cheers, Brett.
New subscriber geography trivia. He just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.
Jamestown. Remember those nuts? Today's new subscriber is Benjamin W. And he is technically not a new subscriber. He is somebody who recently doubled his monthly contribution to School Sucks Podcast. That is greatly appreciated. And I have never done a new subscriber geography trivia segment for him in the past, so here it is. Benjamin is from Richmond, Virginia. That's two Virginias in a row. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Edit that out. That was stupid. Well, maybe leave it in. Do you know that Richmond, Virginia has 203 sites on the National Register of Historic Places, including St. John's Church? You should see a picture of this thing. It was built in 1741, and it still stands today. It is the site where Patrick Henry gave his famous fiery speech, in which he uttered the famous line, "Give me liberty or give me death." He didn't talk that way at all. So it was March 1775, and the Second Virginia Convention was taking place at the church. The 120 delegates present included Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. George Washington, by the way, the step-grandfather of George Washington Park Custis, from the last new subscriber, Geography Trivia. Future President Benjamin Harrison was also there, along with good old Francis Lightfoot Lee. And what these radical lunatics were debating was the question of whether or not to raise a militia to resist encroachments on civil rights by the British government under King George III. After a long session, the House was still undecided on whether to mobilize for military action. Henry, a planter, lawyer, and politician from the area, stood up and he said, "Is life so dear?" Again, that's not how he talked at all. "Or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." He dropped his mic, and then it was time for a revolution. Bam. Shortly after this meeting, Virginia got its third capital, the one that it still has today, Richmond. In 1780, during the revolution, the capital moved from Williamsburg. It had originally been Jamestown. Remember those nuts? But in 1780, it moved from Williamsburg to Richmond in order to provide a more centralized location for Virginia's growing westerly population, and also to provide protection from the possible British attack. But that didn't work out, because in 1781, under the command of the traitor Benedict Arnold, Richmond was burned by British troops, and Thomas Jefferson, the governor, was forced to flee. The city recovered quickly from the war and was thriving again. By 1782, after being burned, resilient Richmond, Virginia, never to be burned again. Just kidding, they're about to get burned again. Here's that story. Because Richmond was not only the capital of Virginia, in the 1860s, it also became the capital of the Confederacy, and that made it a major target of Union armies during the campaigns of 1862, 1864, and 1865. While most of the factories needed to produce artillery and munitions for the Civil War were in the north, Richmond was home to the largest factory in the Confederacy, the Tredegar Iron Works. The first attempt in the summer of 1862 to take the city by Union General George McClellan failed because he was a very small man and a very bad general. But the situation for the Confederacy was much different 3 years later, and due to weakened forces, the capital became indefensible. In April of 1865, General Philip Sheridan teamed up with George Pickett at the Five Forks Junction, broke Confederate lines, and killed one-tenth of Robert E. Lee's defending forces. Robert E. Lee, by the way, the son-in-law of George Washington Park Custis. And at this point, Richmond ceased to be the capital of the Confederacy.
Confederate President Jefferson Davis evacuated the city. He and his cabinet left the city on an overnight train. Government officials stayed behind to burn documents, while the Confederate troops, also in the process of leaving the city, burned tobacco warehouses to deny the spoils to the Union victors. Union General Philip Sheridan, who loved to burn things, left in his wake raging fires that destroyed nearly a quarter of the city's buildings. So, where did Jefferson Davis and the Confederate leadership go next? And was Richmond the place where the Confederacy met its demise? If you live in Danville or Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia, sign up for the AV Club to find out the answers to those questions.
New subscriber geography trivia.